Well, welcome to Song of Night, everyone. And I wanted to start this evening by revisiting something that Prasadachitta mentioned last week. So at the beginning of his presentation, he mentioned that we were on a short two-day meditation retreat, we being myself, Prasadachitta, Vimalamoksha, and Viradhamma. And we spent 2 days together, you know, meditating, going for walks, and checking in, just really deeply listening to each other, being really curious about each other's experience, because we really hadn't spent a lot of time together in, since 2019, the end of 2019, actually, so it had been quite some time. And at the end of this, of our time together, when we were reporting out, you know, Prasadachitta mentioned this last week. He mentioned this distinction between clarity and depth, and I was very moved by it. So I just wanted to repeat to you what Prasadachitta noticed on this retreat. He hadn't heard anything new, per se, from me, Viradhamma, and Vimalamoksha in our check-ins. Like, there was nothing in the content that surprised him. However, he was experiencing the three of us with much greater depth. Like, he was just taking us in much more deeply. And as Prasadachitta was saying this, I noticed that I, too, had a very similar experience. And it turned out we all did. We were all just taking each other in much more deeply. And, of course, it really helps to actually be together for 2 days in a natural environment rather than on Zoom for a couple hours. It's like night and day. It really is. Yeah, so this experience of clarity versus depth, I think it's a very interesting topic. And it's a very interesting aspect of our experience to explore. So it reminded me of this one teaching which describes the three levels of wisdom. So Pete, if I could ask you to share your screen and show that image of the three levels of wisdom, that would be great. Fantastic. Thank you so much, Pete. So the three levels of wisdom in Sanskrit, they are referred to as Sutta-maya Prajna, Chinta-maya Prajna, and Bhavana-maya Prajna. So I've made my own translations for these terms, and on top I translated Sutta-maya Prajna as intellectual understanding. And that's a very poetic translation. It's probably better to call that an interpretation rather than a translation. So Sutta-maya Prajna, intellectual understanding, is the first level of wisdom. The second level of wisdom, Chinta-maya Prajna, is reflection and contemplation. And Bhavana-maya Prajna, I interpret as embodied knowing. So these words, these Sanskrit words, sutta, this word means listening. And the more literal translation is wisdom through listening. So during the time of the Buddha, Buddhism was an oral tradition. So that's how you learned the Dharma. That's how you learned the teachings of the Buddha. You listened. And if you really wanted to go deeper with these teachings, then you had no choice but to memorize these teachings. And of course, then to reflect and contemplate on them more deeply. And as that knowledge begins to deepen, then it becomes embodied knowing. So in terms of intellectual thinking, I think that our Western scientific materialistic culture, and also the age of the internet, there's a strong predisposition that we have within this culture towards intellectual understanding. So it's information. So we have a question, we don't know the answer, we just get on Google and we find it out. Check the box, now I know. And that would be intellectual understanding. So from a Buddhist perspective, this here is just a starting point of wisdom. And if we want to explore the depths of Buddhism, to really go deeper, we need to enter into the second and third levels of wisdom, being Chintamaya Prajna and Bhavanamaya Prajna. So Chinta, this word means to think or thinking. It's reflection and contemplation. So after we have a clear intellectual understanding of the teaching, then the next step in terms of Chintamaya Prajna is that's where we explore our experience in relationship to this new teaching that we've heard. In what ways is my experience aligned with this teaching? In what ways is it not aligned with this teaching? And I think it's very interesting, this reflection and contemplation, because I notice this in my experience, and I imagine others do as well. I can get a sense of what I think by listening to the words that come out of my mouth. I can also get a sense of what I think by looking at my actions. And I find that this does happen frequently. I don't know how frequently. It certainly happened frequently in the earlier days of practice, where I noticed that the stories that were coming out of my mouth were actually quite different than the story I would reconstruct if I were to just examine my actions. So I find that quite interesting. And we can also reflect in terms of externally and internally. So we can examine how these teachings are impacting our internal experience and also our external experience. And then the third level, Bhavanamaya Prajna. Bhavana, this is the same word that's used in the Metta Bhavana. And the Metta Bhavana is the meditation on the cultivation of loving kindness. So Bhavana means cultivating. So the translation would be the cultivation of wisdom. And I prefer the interpretation of embodied knowing. So this third level of wisdom is where we actually experience what it is that these teachings are pointing at. We feel it in our bodies. We know it in our minds. We feel it in our hearts. And it's a wordless knowing. It's a wordless experience. So to go deeper, we need to go well beyond the intellectual understanding. So what I'd like to do now is actually to do a little reflection exercise. So Pete, if you could go to page 2 on that document. Perfect. Thank you, Pete. So the second quote is the James Baldwin quote that I read at the end of our meditation. And the upper quote is also a James Baldwin quote, and it's the condensed version of that quote. So what I'll be saying after the tea break revolves around this quote, what James Baldwin is referring to. But before I speak about this topic, what I'd like to invite us all to do is engage in just about a 3-minute reflection practice. And what this is going to look like is I'm simply going to read the second quote, and I'm actually going to read it twice. And we'll just have a few minutes just to turn this quote over in our minds, and we can just notice what arises. So you're welcome to either close your eyes and just listen to my voice, or you can read along on the screen as I read it. So I'll read it, we'll sit quietly for a few minutes, and then I'll read it again, then I'll ring a bell. History, as nearly no one seems to know, is not merely something to be read. And it does not refer merely, or even principally, to the past. On the contrary, the great force of history comes from the fact that we carry it within us, are unconsciously controlled by it in many ways, and history is literally present in all that we do. it could scarcely be otherwise, since it is to history that we owe our frames of reference, our identities, and our aspirations. So let's just sit quietly for a couple minutes. To create some space. To explore with greater depth. That which James Baldwin is pointing towards with this quote. History, as nearly no one seems to know, is not merely something to be read, and it does not refer merely, or even principally, to the past. On the contrary, the great force of history comes from the fact that we carry it with us, within us, are unconsciously controlled by it in many ways, and history is literally present in all that we do. It could scarcely be otherwise, since it is to history that we owe our frames of reference, our identities, and our aspirations. So, Pete, if I could ask you to end the screen share. Thank you. Okay, so now we're going to take about a 7-minute tea break. And then when we come back, I'll be exploring what the Pali Canon has to say about history. And then after that, we'll be breaking into small breakout rooms of probably 3 people each. We'll have a chance to share whatever thoughts have arisen for us. And then we'll come back together as a large group and be able to share with the large group anything that, that came up in our smaller groups. All right? So let's all come back at around, I'd say, 8:05. See you in a few minutes. Okay. So what does the Buddha have to say about history? Yeah, I was very fascinated by this James Baldwin quote. There's something about it that just really grabbed my attention. And it has, that James Baldwin quote has actually stayed at the fore of my mind for multiple weeks now. It's been quite some time. Something about that quote that's really alive for me. So then I started to, exploring the Pali Canon through the lens of this particular perspective, that history matters. And I'd like to share with you now what I noticed. So one of the places where the Buddha speaks about history is when he describes his experience of becoming enlightened. So the story goes that, he was sitting under a Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya. And as he was sitting right at the doorstep of enlightenment, at this doorstep of liberation, he began to see clearly the nature of how things truly are. So one of the things that he saw was he was able to recollect his past lives. So I'm going to read this section. It's about two paragraphs from the Mahasanchaka Sutta, where he describes his process of recollecting his past lives. When my mind was thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of defilement, pliant, malleable, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to the knowledge of recollecting my past lives. I recollected my manifold past lives, one birth, two births, 5, 10, 50, 100, 1,000, 100,000 births, many eons of cosmic contraction, many eons of cosmic expansion, many eons of cosmic contraction and expansion. There, I had such a name, belonged to such a clan, had such an appearance, such was my food, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such the end of my life. Thus, I remembered my manifold past lives in their modes and details. Yeah, so before I get into the content of what the Buddha is talking about here, it's important to know that there are at least two different approaches to exploring this notion of recollecting past lives. Especially 100,000 past lives. So we can explore this text through the lens of historical fact. Is this actually true? And we can also explore this text. We can explore its poetic truth. We can relate to this as a wisdom story, much in the way that we can relate to fairy tales as wisdom stories. So in terms of the perspective of historical fact, the great scholar Anaglio, he wrote a book in 2018 that was entitled Rebirth in Early Buddhism and Current Research. So if you are interested in exploring the notion of the recollection of past lives as historical fact, I point you towards Anaglio's book. I've not read it. I've read some reviews about it, so I have a sense of the terrain, but it's just not quite my cup of tea, so I doubt I'm going to pick that book up. But there's that historical fact perspective, and Anaglio is a fantastic guide to the Buddhist tradition, to the early Buddhist tradition. So I'm going to approach this passage for its poetic truth. So in terms of the poetic truth behind it, well, first of all, in terms of past lives, this is part of the Buddhist tradition, rebirth. And there are those who are more predisposed towards the letter of the law. And from that perspective, one may hear this, something like, well, rebirth is part of the Buddhist tradition, and if you do not believe in rebirth, then you're not really a Buddhist. So I've heard that perspective before. Anaglio, even though he's an incredible scholar, in this book, Rebirth in Early Buddhism and Current Research, he, even though he's exploring it through the lens of historical fact, he even comes out and says he doesn't consider it to be all that important in terms of practicing the Dharma. So I find that quite interesting. So in terms of the poetic truth, I can certainly recollect my own life, the significant events in my life that have shaped me, that have shaped who I am. And actually, within the Tri Ratna, within the ordination training process, one of the exercises that we do with that group of people is we will share life stories with each other. And it's a very powerful practice to share life stories with each other. You know, first there's the aspect of speaking one's truth and being witnessed by others. But then there's this really important aspect of when we actually review our lives, we can notice the patterns of our lives, the habits of our lives, our habitual tendencies, the things we keep doing over and over and over again. And then we can also get a sense of how those particular habits came to be. So that's the way that I relate to this teaching here of recollecting one's past lives. I can relate to this poetically as just simply reviewing my own life and noticing those important moments that have shaped who I am. So in terms of the past, I think it's quite interesting, this term samya. So on week one of this series, so that was on July 1st, I spoke about the Giramananda Sutta, and that sutta spoke about the ways in which our perception can become distorted by greed, hatred, and delusion, and then gives a series of practices to purify those distortions so that we may arrive at clear seeing. And also on that first week, I read a definition from the Pali Canon of what this word samya, or perception, is pointing at. And perception is simply pointing at the act of recognizing something for what it is. So the act of perception would simply be cup or bell or table, shirt, person, masculinity, femininity, whatever it may be. So that's simply all samya, this word samya, or perception, is pointing at in the Buddhist tradition. It's just this act of labeling. So if you think about this process, so to take this simple example of a cup, the only way I can recognize this as a cup, the only way that I can samya, or perceive this as a cup, I must already have some sort of a mental image in my mind of a cup. Or perhaps I should say of cupness, the qualities of a cup, so that I can recognize this is a cup, and I can also recognize this is a cup, even though they look quite different. I know what those characteristics are. Ah, cup. So this mental image we have in our minds, it's actually coming from the past. Because where did we get that image? How did we come up with that image? Well, it obviously came up from past experience where we've learned that this is a cup, and then we remembered it. And then as we're walking around in our, you know, in our present moment experience, and we are going through this process of samyaing things, I'm actually mapping past experiences or past images onto my present experience. So we can even think of this act of samyaing as an act of mapping the past into the present. So now this really interesting thing about mapping the past into the present, I mean, it's really not very interesting when we're talking about a cup. That's just to explain it. But now let's talk about actually the experience of being triggered. Or more extreme would be post-traumatic stress that arises. So perhaps you're having a conversation with someone, and the person you're talking to has a criticism for you. And perhaps as a child, your primary caregivers were very critical of you as a child. And you experience a lot of anxiety and stress around that, around being criticized. There's something that we've learned as a child that maybe we're not good enough or we're not lovable because our parents always were criticizing us. And we can bring that into the present. So in this conversation, somebody criticizes us, and that may trigger this memory that we have of being criticized by our parents when we were growing up. Because there's a pattern recognition here. And not only does, this is criticism, I recognize this, but a whole host of other things from the past can arise as well and be brought into the present. So for example, I might then start to think, I'm being criticized, man, I'm such an idiot. I can never get this right. I don't know anything. I'm so stupid. And so all of these stories may arise in our minds that are actually coming from the past. And that's what this word triggered, you know, can point to. So we map our past experience into the present. And then, of course, the nature of habit is also coming from the past. So I think a really interesting definition of the self, there's many definitions, I like to refer to the self, it's this bundle of habits that I call me. That's what I think of the self. It's a bundle of habits. And if you look at your life, you will definitely notice that there are a lot of habitual activities that we engage in. And there's also a lot of habitual thought patterns that we engage in as well. Being criticized, I'm not good enough, I'm not lovable, I'm stupid. Those are actually all habitual thought patterns. So habits come from the past. Sangharakshita, he teaches this, he makes this distinction of a reactive mind and a creative mind. So the reactive mind is kind of like a chasing one's tail or running around in circles or just reacting to our stimuli. And a creative mind is something that is leaning towards a much more spacious and connected experience, one with less suffering. So I really love this word reactive. Because if you break it down, it says to re-act. So re means to repeat an action, re-act, and to do this over and over and over and over again. So of course, when it becomes habituated, when our actions become habituated, and then we enter into autopilot, those actions just become unconscious. We don't even need to think about it. Because we just react as such. And, of course, one of the most important teachings about the past from the Buddhist tradition is the teaching of Pratityasamutpada. And this term has many translations, and the one that I like the most is dependent co-arising. Dependent co-arising. This teaching just simply says that everything arises based upon conditions. But I'd actually like to read to you how the Buddha teaches this in the Pali Canon. So I'll just read these four lines from you from the Dasabala Sutta, and where the Buddha teaches this teaching of dependent co-arising in its most succinct formulation. So this is what the Buddha says. When this exists, that is. Due to the arising of this, that arises. When this does not exist, that is not. Due to the cessation of this, that ceases. So it's interesting when you read the Pali Canon, even though I know this verse quite well, there is still this voice in my head that's like, what? What's that supposed to mean? So there's definitely a lot of translation, you know, even from English to of 2,600 years ago in ancient India to our modern cultural condition. We actually need to even translate that. When this exists, that is. Due to the arising of this, that arises. When this doesn't exist, that is not. Due to the cessation of this, that ceases. So this, once again, it's a fancy way of saying everything rises based upon conditions. So, for example, take this example I gave earlier of being in a conversation, being criticized by someone, that triggering a past response of, I'm not good enough, I'm stupid, I'm not worthy. Well, that habitual way of thinking, I'm not good enough, that arose based on some specific conditions. It didn't just pop out of nowhere. Well, I don't know, maybe it did. There is the whole nature versus nurture debate. But for the sake of this discussion, I'm just going to focus on the nurture aspect. The way in which our environment, as we're growing up, shapes who we are. So in this example, this experience of I'm not good enough, I'm not worthy, I'm stupid, that has arisen based upon specific conditions. When those conditions exist, this is what arises. And then the path forward, according to the Buddhist tradition, is when we can see the conditions upon which a particular experience has arisen. Well then, if we can remove those conditions, then that which has arisen will also be eliminated. And that's what the second stanza says. When this does not exist, that is not. Due to the sensation of this, that ceases. So it's conditionality. So I got into this really interesting conversation with a friend of mine who's been working as an actor for probably 40 years, 30 years, something like that. And he had to stop working for a period of time during the pandemic, during the shelter-at-home period. And now where he lives, people are starting to go back out again and starting to gather with socially distant guidelines. So he started to teach again. And I asked him, how's that going? And he told me something really interesting. He said to me, well, you know, it's been a while since I've taught, so I'm a little rusty. I'm a little out of practice. And I noticed that my inner voice, I have this imposter syndrome going on. Like, I feel like I'm an imposter. Even though I've been doing this for 40 years, I still feel like I'm, at some level, I'm an imposter. So I thought that was so interesting that he named this. So it's very interesting to even explore that experience, which I'm going to with my friend. Well, how did that arise? So I'm actually quite interested in exchanging life stories with this friend, and particularly exploring a life story around this theme of the imposter syndrome, you know, something that's obviously very alive and well in his mind, in his imagination. And just to get a clearer sense for both him and myself of where that way of thinking came about. Right, so going back to this James Baldwin quote, it says, the great force of history comes from the fact that we carry it within us, are unconsciously controlled by it in many ways, and history is literally present in all that we do. It could scarcely be otherwise, since it is to history that we owe our frames of reference, our identities, and our aspirations. That James Baldwin quote really packs a punch. So I've been speaking about internal, our internal conditioning, if you will, or our internal experience of I'm not good enough, I'm stupid in one case, and imposter syndrome in another case. These are internal experiences which arise based upon conditions. Well, we can also have behaviors that are externally conditioned or culturally conditioned. So here's one example of a book I read many years ago. It was by Elizabeth Gilbert called Eat, Pray, Love. In the third part of the book, in the love part of the book, she's in Bali. And I remember this scene she describes, where she describes spending time with an indigenous group of people. And she witnessed this one ritual that they do. And the ritual was that it occurs 6 months after the birth of a baby. Right? So this particular group of indigenous people, they believed that when a baby was born, that there were earth spirits who wanted to take the baby's soul, because I don't know, I guess they love babies, right? So the only way that these earth spirits could take the souls of babies is if the baby touched the ground. So what this indigenous tribe did was, for the first 6 months of a baby's life, they would never set the baby directly on the earth, because they didn't want the earth spirits to take the baby's soul. And then after 6 months, they would have this little ritual where they would gather up the entire tribe, and they would do this whole ritual. And what they did with the baby was they had the baby here, but then they also had this little doll that looked like the baby. So it was the fake baby. And during this ritual, they would take the doll and they would put the doll on the ground. And the idea was that it was like an offering to the earth spirits to give the soul of the baby to the earth spirits. But they were doing it with the doll. So the idea was they were tricking the earth spirits and then the baby would be safe. So the reason I named this story is because I thought to myself, huh, that is really interesting. So imagine if you had been born and raised in that indigenous tribe, and you had had no contact with any other tribes or any other cultures, and that's all that you knew. Well, then you would see this ritual. You would ask your parents what's going on. They would explain it to you. And you would have no other frame of reference. As a result, it would just seem completely normal, completely true. There would be nothing to question there. Just, well, that's just the way it is. Now, of course, for us, coming from the West, from this materialistic, scientific culture that we have, where truth reigns supreme, if you will, or historical fact, it's very easy for us to dismiss that, to think, oh, well, that is what it is, but I don't believe it. So it's very interesting to think about that, that the extent to which we either believe or disbelieve this story of earth spirits taking away the souls of babies, the degree to which we believe or not believe this story, it's culturally conditioned. We simply will absorb the narratives, the stories of those around us. And we do that right from the start. So when James Baldwin speaks about this, that the great force of history, it unconsciously controls us in many ways, I think this is what he's pointing at. So then when we come into relationship with people, we're dealing with our own histories, our own past wounding, our own past traumas, just our entire past. And that's coming into relationship. It's interacting with the past and history of another person. So I think this is something to be very sensitive to, is that when we are interacting with a person of color who has experienced oppression and marginalization. I think it's very important for us, for me, to be sensitive to that fact, and actually to be quite curious about that fact, that history shapes us. Okay, so what I'd like to do now is I would like to invite Pete to break us into breakout rooms of groups of three, and we'll each have about kind of 2 to 3 minutes to share in these groups, and then we'll come back together in a large group after that. So Pete, while you are setting up the breakout rooms, I will just read this James Baldwin quote one more time. History, as nearly no one seems to know, is not merely something to be read, and it does not refer merely or even principally to the past. On the contrary, the great force of history comes from the fact that we carry it within us, are unconsciously controlled by it in many ways, and history is literally present in all that we do. It could scarcely be otherwise, since it is to history that we owe our frames of reference, our identities, and our aspirations.